Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
you are uprooted and have come to belong.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Today I'm going to start in one place and probably seem to end in a completely other place, which some of you might reasonably argue is just me doing a standard Sunday message. But very genuinely, I am hoping, as I do what I'm trying to do, I want to conjure or reawaken a high sense of sacred for us in a very regular part of our lives, our relationship to ourselves and others. So off we go. We're going to be in Genesis today. And Genesis is Genesis 1 specifically, and 2. It's poetic. It's the rhythmic telling, the story of how everything and everybody got here. But I want to present it to you in a way that honors the text beyond, well, did this happen or not? A lot of us, we get hung up on that, and we're a little intimidated by the text because of those questions. That question, well, wait a minute, did Genesis 1 and 2, the creation story, did that happen that way or not? That puts us often in a defensive posture from the outset. And that's not our job, to defend the Bible. Defending it as a science document or as a historical documentary of actual events, that sets it and us up to be dismissed because it can't really carry that weight. So starting on a defensive footing, that's really starting with anxiety and fear. And that can tend to give away that we maybe know on some level that we're involving ourselves in something not super solid. It's like defending a chair you're claiming is the one true, most powerful chair. But the more you're defending it and not allowing questions, you're kind of revealing that you're actually suspicious yourself about your claims, that it's possible that that chair can't hold any weight at all. So we're not coming to Genesis today, the story of creation, to make it dance for us so that we can retain its what we think is a dogmatic requirement that we have to believe it's literally true and falsifies science. So we're not doing any of that. None of that's necessary. None of that's good. We're going to come to it to participate in a much older, far richer, deeper tradition of listening to the text for what it might have for us beyond a black and white reading. Okay? So, rather famously, it begins with, in the beginning. And it's hilarious to me that first couple of words has been the subject of so much debate for hundreds of years. There's some new translations that try to be truer to the ancient Hebrew. I don't speak Hebrew at all. But I'm told that the newer translations are more accurate, even though they don't sound as traditional. When God began to create the heavens and the earth. And so it says, you know, God began to create the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and void, or wild and waste, some of our translations say. That phrase comes from an ancient Hebrew phrase, tohu wa bohu. And once again, a ton of debate about this. That phrase is used one other place in the Hebrew scriptures outside of Genesis. It refers to a battlefield after the battle. And so it looks to mean something like somebody or something already laid waste to what was. There's a huge mess. There's chaos and ruin. So I say that from the outset so that you can appreciate that this artful telling of the creation of all things is predicated. It starts with or is built on undoing chaos, bringing order from chaos, order and beauty from ruin. Okay, so I think that's an important framework for our discussion today. So let's read the text and we'll make some observations. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, when God began to create the heavens and the earth was complete chaos. And darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome, and it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening, and there was morning, the second day. And God said, let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear, and it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas, and God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth put forth vegetation. Interesting, let the earth put forth vegetation. Plants yielding seed and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation. Plants yielding seed of every kind and trees of every kind bearing fruit with it, with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years. And let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the waters bring forth swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the dome of the sky. So God created the great sea monsters and every living creature that moves of every kind, with which the waters swarm, and every winged bird of every kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let the birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things and wild animals of the earth of every kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind and the cattle of every kind and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make humans in our image according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over the cattle and over all the wild animals of the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth. So God created humans in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God said, see, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree with seed in its fruit, you shall have them for food. And to every beast of the field, and to every bird of the air, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. Not just good, very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. On the sixth day God finished the work that he had done, and he had rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So that's the text. That's chapter 1 and a little bit of chapter 2. An absolutely iconic text. Has shaped so much art and culture, tradition, discussion, identity. And there's a ton there that we could probably talk every Sunday for the rest of the year about. And maybe the impact it has on you, as we were reading it just now, is that you get hung up on, but that's not how things happened. and so you're struggling to believe it. And we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about that today, but I just recognize a lot of us get hung up on that, especially if you work in science or appreciate science. And so what this brings up is how it may or may not fail as a text if it's supposed to be believed as written. And so then that leads us to ask questions like, well, if that's the measure of its value, whether or not it happened like that or not, where does that leave me or you and the faith community? Again, whether or not this is meant to depict actual events, that's ultimately a terrible litmus test for its value or for the sincerity of our faith. So I want to try to dig deeper than that. And what does deeper mean? Well, there's probably countless ways of understanding this text. You can study that on your own for the next year, all the different ways of looking at this text over the generations. The surface layer interpretation is this historically accurate or not? That's how you first come at it. Did this happen the way that it was written? Is it accurate or not? And then therefore, do we believe it as correct or do we dismiss it as incorrect? But there are other views, not so much hung up on the literal reading, but receiving it as something more, like what does the poetry, the figurative language represent? And what does that mean in an admittedly pre-scientific culture? It does try to describe a loose chronology of nothing becoming everything. And if not nothing, chaos, ruin, becoming order and beauty. This loose chronology, which opens up all kinds of interesting conversations because of the things that actually have some significance and some legitimacy to them. Then there's discussions about this text being a nuanced, context-specific piece of ancient poetry, wisdom literature that didn't necessarily seek or intend to say anything about how things actually came into existence, but is a very cleverly written folk prequel to the Exodus. Because you may or may not know, the Exodus story is the centerpiece for the ancient Israelites getting out of ancient Egyptian slavery. That's what the whole thing is about. And so Genesis can serve as the opening scene or the prequel that's leading to the climactic story of Moses taking the enslaved Hebrew people out of Egyptian slavery to the Promised Land. So there is the creation story as poetic wisdom literature that in large part sets up all the players, all the scenes, all the values for the Exodus scene. Then there's really interesting, very deep interpretations like the functional or the temple view. And what this is an interpretation where the creation story is an allegory for every part of a sanctuary, the holy place of God, where this is an allegory depicting God as assigning function and role to what was previously meaningless, chaotic, empty, so that everything in the known universe becomes a fully articulated, purpose-filled place for God to dwell, like a cosmic temple. Really fascinating writings and discussions about that. Here's a personal favorite of mine, because it both highlights what the text is doing, not just what it is saying, but what the text is doing with what it's saying. So there's an interesting, I don't know if that just made sense, but it'll make sense in a second. There's an interesting symmetry in Genesis 1 about how these days are laid out, one that theologians call the framework hypothesis. So you may have in your mind as you're reading Genesis, each of these days, symbolic days, as they probably are, being laid out in succession. So I've got props. So you think of it this way. Day one was let there be light and separating the light from the darkness, day and night. Day two is separating sky above from sea below. By the way, the sky above means the there waters, and then there are the waters. So when you say sky or heavens in the ancient Hebrew, there's a way of understanding it. They're saying waters here and then the there waters. They're related words. Day three is then the land appears separated from the water, and then plants grow. Day four, you have the sun and the moon and the stars in the sky. Day five, birds and fish. Day six, animals. We're animals. And then day seven, rest. The framework hypothesis highlights that it's not just a week being laid out, but it's also establishing first realms or domains, and then those realms and domains being populated. So the way that you think about it is day one says, let there be light, and then day and night. And then that corresponds to day four, the sun and the moon being those lights. And then day two is about sky and sea. And that corresponds to day... Well, I hope this is coming through on camera. I could have done this, I guess, in post. we could have probably made a really cool graphic, but I just like sticky notes. And so day two, sky and sea, corresponds with day five, birds and fish. Maybe you're getting ahead of me and realizing, okay, then day three is dry land and veggies. That goes with day six. Dry land and veggies go with all the animals and the people who will be living on the land and eating the fruit. And then you have rest. And so the idea being that first you have to create the domain, the realm, before you populate it. You have to make the container before you fill it. You can't do work right in the wrong setting. So first, the circumstances, the context, the environment, the setting is created. And this, to me, is a brilliant example of probably countless examples of how you can keep coming back to the text and asking new questions, making new observations with a very familiar text that you probably think, I get it, but keep coming back to it with openness and curiosity. This is a prime example of how you can sit down with a kid rather than being intimidated because you're not sure if it really happened that way. You can sit with a kid, you can read the Bible with a high degree of respect and just get used to asking questions, trying to make observations, listening to other people's observations without feeling like the only choices are, I either have to shove dogma and pseudoscience down the kid's throat in the name of faith, or I'll just ignore it and hope that when I take them to church, somebody like their small group leader will handle it really well. We do far better bringing our questions and our curiosity to the text than bringing our answers and our defenses. It's far better to open ourselves to seeing something new and maybe valuable to our journey, which is, of course, the journey of becoming more loving. That's the point. Not being more right, but more loving. And it's this last thing that I want to close with today. Something valuable to us and to our lives. Something poetically portrayed in and by the text, and yet very tangibly important to the world we find ourselves in today. No matter what interpretive lens we come to the text with, I think it's worth asking questions about day seven. I want to notice that there is rest, and this message isn't about rest or Sabbath, although I hope you have some rest scheduled soon. I know you need it, whoever you are. But I want you to notice that there's rest at the end of the creation week. And I don't know what it looks like for Almighty God to take some me time. Because, you know, maybe after a week of work, God only feels half mighty rather than all. I don't know. Maybe we're supposed to imagine God being into hammocks or lounging on a pool inflatable at the end of the week. But if God walks on water, does God need the inflatable? See, these are the kinds of questions that... Bottom line, at the end of all that has been made, God says it's all very good. Tov me'od. It's so good. It's beautiful. That's where everything starts. Not with brokenness and the fall and all that. It's all so good. And then God rests. But there was no labor. See, another huge interpretive lens that we can apply here is that this creation story is written in a time when there are several other creation stories in circulation that are more popular, better known. And almost every one of them, written before or after, involve creation by force as the fruit of conflict or violence. We talked about this a couple months ago, but there's the tearing apart of bodies, of lives, of dragons or whatever, being ripped in half so that you get a world that is the result of chaos, a universe cobbled together from the corpses and the blood of enemies. Tohu, wabohu. But this narrative in Genesis, this is God speaking things into being, which is inherently nonviolent. And then once it's completed, this speaking everything into existence, God rests. why rest from something that didn't involve work? It's not labor. Unless there's a reminder here. In this opening text of a whole book of words, that speaking is a creative force, just as effective, if not more so, than the work of hands. The wisdom here may be reminding us that words, whoever you are, it doesn't matter who you think you are or aren't listening to this, whoever you are, you have the power to create. Your words create worlds, creates the world around you. And anything with the power to create has the power to destroy. Proverbs 12:18 says, rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. Proverbs 18:21, death and life are in the power of the tongue, and those who love it will eat its fruits, one way or another. Death or life. Proverbs 29:20, do you see a man who's hasty in his words, that just talks before he's really thought about it? There's more hope for an idiot, for a fool, than for him. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, let no corrupting talk. A lot of the translations we grew up with said unwholesome, which who knows what that means. But corrupting has the connotation from the original Greek here is like of rot. Let no rotten, corrupting talk come out of your mouth. That's not about cuss words. Listen. Only say that is good for building up somebody as fits the occasion. Read the room, that it may give grace to those who hear. Speak in such a way that builds, that lifts up, that constructs, not ruins, rots, and destroys. I don't know what you believe about God, the Bible, let alone Genesis 1 and 2. But regardless of what you believe or don't believe or still negotiating in your head, my sincere hope is that you would just recognize on at least the authority of your own experience, your own observations, that what we choose to say to ourselves and to others, how we speak to the world, is very often, far more often than maybe we appreciate in this world of quick responses and very little consideration, how we speak to and about each other comes from a choice. A choice to build or knock down. A choice to find what's working and speak to that and focus on that. Or a choice to focus on the problems and complain again and again and again. A choice to participate in solutions, or a choice to point out flaws and what could go wrong. A choice to be kind in the face of others' unkindnesses and recklessnesses, or the choice to slap back at the same level of awareness. The choice to speak well of somebody who isn't in the room, even though you know some stuff, but you want to honor their dignity, or the choice to gossip and to fall for that common enemy trick where it makes you feel closer to somebody that is in the room to talk badly about somebody who isn't. The beginning of our sacred literature depicts God as making things with creative, thoughtful, considerate speech, and then resting, because words carry constructive weight. They are a work. And so there comes a time to stop talking at the end of the creating. They do things, or why speak at all? And so I wonder if one way we can move into the world as we find it, a world so packed full of beauty, but frankly, also can be found to be tohu wabohu in many ways. I wonder if one way we can move into the world is to first and foremost get good at recognizing all our words, spoken or typed or even rehearsed in our own heads about ourselves, what we say to our own selves. To recognize our words can always contribute to creation, to constructing something better. Our words can always have the capacity, and even the smallest comments, for building, for constructing. Especially when spoken where the habit of speaking judgment, criticizing, knocking down, just saying something based on a feeling you haven't even really processed, where complaining, where all of that has been spoken before, that your words could actually be used for construction in that same space. For most of us, there's a very real autopilot habit for using words to defend ourselves and our intentions the second somebody says they've got a problem with what we've done. As soon as it happens, we're defending ourselves and trying to push down what somebody said without listening. A reflexive impulse to tear other people down, especially if we already feel low. A reflex to punish or hit back with our words because we are terrified of looking weak. We dehumanize those who behave badly. And it doesn't feel wrong because obviously they're the ones that are wrong. They started it. But a reflex that's like, it's a refusal to account for another's human dignity. Well, but they don't honor other people's dignity. I'm just doing back to them what they did. And we're not building, we're destroying it. It's a habit. On the global scale, we can now see people all around the world and speak destructively to them without ever meeting them. We can speak destructively globally now. Just you and I, nobodies. We can feed into the tohu wabohu of the planet because of the internet and social media. And look at it. Our words, when we live in this space, it does not create. On balance, we have tohu wabohu'd each other to hell. But the repentance and the repair we're invited into, it's not some big global thing. It just starts with you and me. Just you, just me, today. How do you personally deal with being misunderstood or mistreated? I know it doesn't feel good, but how do you speak to that? What habits of speech, reflexive speech, do you have, even in your own mind toward yourself or in your mouth toward others, that over the years have become more tuned for hitting back, for demanding to be understood the way you want to be understood, more than trying to create understanding? What if you learned to feel defensive, but spoke only to that which would create space for something new and better? Did you know that you can be kind to unkind people and still not let them get their chaos into your life? You can love someone and create a boundary rather than not create the boundary and work to, with your words, destroy their wrong ideas or their toxic attitudes. Even on a broad level, we can be appalled at the speech of powerful people, how they speak about human beings and create destructive, dehumanizing policies, influencing other people to join their narrow, awful vision. We can see all that and have legitimate, honest reviews about that and real feelings about that, and then ask, how can I move in the currents of the wise, compassionate, powerful spirit of life without falling into ruinous speech? Without joining in the chorus of the destructive voice of cynicism, dehumanization, contempt, and death. And to stop believing, well, they did it. And so I'm just mirroring back to them their same energy. How then might I live and speak light right into the face of chaos and shadow? And see, this isn't just out there. This starts with how you and I speak to ourselves. When you speak creation and potential to yourself about who you are, you can become that far better for others. When we honor our own courage rather than tearing ourselves down, but like be kind to ourselves, hey, I'm doing pretty good with this and this and this, then you will speak more encouragement to other people. When we are somebody who can speak to ourselves as comfortable in our own skin, or you know what, at least comfortable with being uncomfortable in our own skin. The more we do that, the more we can speak acceptance and validation to other people, regardless of who they are or aren't. When we stop honoring or believing the speech of the inner critic, I don't know about yours, but mine just never shuts up sometimes. But I don't believe it as much as I used to. I don't bow to it and honor it like I used to. As we do that internally, that reduces the criticism we might have of others. That is to say, you and I will be better at bringing blessing and light to others to the exact extent that we no longer try to build ourselves up by tearing ourselves down. Starting this very hour with yourself, with your children, or with the neighbor kids, with every human being, in your life that you like or don't like, because they're all made in the image of the divine. They're all part of what's very good. Starting right now, with every part of your life, you and I can speak in the ways of creation. And that's the goal. That's how the story that we are part of, that's how it starts. May we in all things participate in the ongoing creation and beautification of a better world, more full of love and kindness, more loaded with the potential for beauty and awe. And then may we know when to stop speaking and let it be. I'm going to give the last words today to Yunus Emre, a Turkish folk poet and Sufi born a mere 785 years ago. I think his poem is beautiful, and I can't think of a better way to use words to wrap up today before I rest from my words. A single word can brighten the face of one who knows the value of words. Ripened in silence, a single word acquires a great energy for work. War is cut short by a word, and a word heals the wounds. And there's a word that changes poison into butter and honey. Let a word mature inside yourself. Withhold the unripened thought. Come and understand the kind of word that reduces money and riches to dust. Know when to speak a word and when not to speak at all. A single word turns the universe of hell into 8 paradises. Follow the way. Don't be fooled by what you already know. Be watchful. Reflect before you speak. A foolish mouth can brand your soul. Yunus, say one last thing about the power of words. Only the word I divides me from God.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.